This is Trainer Talk on HRRN Live.
But it was all for Chuck McGee. Super Saver wins the Derby for Todd Pletcher.
The Salt will give trainer Steve Asmussen career win number 6,000.
It was all have another for Doug O'Neill.
Oxbow and D-Wayne Lucas. Trainer D-Wayne Lucas, the sixth win.
And Al's Rosie is going to give trainer Gary Contessa his 2,000th career win.
And dialed in, never got to them. It was Animal Kingdom for Graham Motion.
Steve Hobby with career victory number 1,000 at Oaklawn.
The show that trainers listen to. Now, here's Mike Penna and Jude Feld.
Good afternoon once again, everyone, and welcome to Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. We do welcome everybody just joining us across the country on Sirius Channel 93. All of you who have been with us, well, on XM 209 for the past few hours, welcome back to the program. And of course, everybody tuning in worldwide on our website, horseracingradio.net. Happy to have you on board for a legendary edition of this Trainer Talk show. Mike Penna, Baron of the Backstretch, Jude Feld, the Pontiff of the Pick Four, our producer Lee Delapina. We are with you in our Lexington, Kentucky studios. And JT, we oftentimes get excited for this Trainer Talk show because our guests are always so engaging and so good. And this show here tonight, very, very special.
Yeah, well, King Leatherberry is a legend. And one of the all-time greats. I believe he's the third winningest trainer of all time. Just outstanding record and a fantastic guy to boot. Great stories and amazing man.
Well, King Leatherberry is going to be with us for the first half of the show this evening. Bill Badgett Jr. will be with us for the second half, so we're not going to waste any time. We will get right to it for you here on Trainer Talk. And our first guest, King Leatherberry, he recently became an octogenarian on March 26th of this year, and over the course of his illustrious career has trained a total of 6,395 career winners with total purse earnings of nearly $61 million. On August 23rd, 2003, he became only the third trainer in history to win 6,000 races. He has recorded more than 50 Maryland training titles at Pimlico and Laurel and was the nation's leading trainer in 1976 and 1977. We do welcome trainer King Leatherberry to Trainer Talk tonight. King, welcome to the program.
My pleasure.
King, obviously a native of Baltimore, so much of what you've done throughout your career has been done right there in your home state of Maryland. How did this remarkable career begin for King Leatherberry?
Well, my father bred horses and owned horses on a small scale, and I graduated from the University of Maryland, and during that time, I mean, what interested me the most was horse racing, and quite frankly, I liked wagering. I liked the handicapping part where you tried to figure out who was going to win a race. That was like a challenge, and so then I spent 2 years in the Army. And during that time, I read as much and studied as much as I could about training horses. And then as soon as I got out of the Army, I just went right ahead and took over my father's horses. At that time, he had five. And started out with five horses down at Sunshine Park, which is now Florida Downs. And that was in 1959. And just as I started to do well and win some races, and you acquire other owners. And I just had one, basically built my stable up literally one horse at a time. At no time have I ever come into a whole stable where somebody's turned a stable of horses over to me. So basically it was just one at a time, and it just grew and grew until I got up to a sizable amount of horses. So we were clicking along, winning, and when you win, of course, it's the best advertisement in the world. So when you win, people will come to you, owners will come to you and ask them to train your horses.
When you're starting out like that from really ground zero, you don't really have many points of reference other than what you've read in books,
right,
and all of that. How did you make that transition from a business student to a horse trainer?
Well, it just came natural, really. I mean, I just went to college to go to college. My parents wanted me to go to college after I got out of high school. And at that time, I didn't know what I was doing. You know how it is, and or at least with me, I didn't know what I wanted to do. And by the time I got through college and the Army, then I just decided this was what I wanted to do. The horse trainers that my father had, I don't want to knock them, but I mean, I'm saying to myself, geez, if those guys can do it, I can do it. So I just dove right into it, and of course, and the mistakes I made, I learned from, and I took advice from people as I came along that were willing to help me, and it just grew, and I just came up from the, so to speak, from just scrapping it out on the bottom.
Well, King Leatherberry joining us here on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. King, I mentioned nearly 6,400 career winners. Your very first, as you mentioned, coming in 1959 at Sunshine Park, which is now Tampa Bay Downs, with a horse by the name of Mr. L. What do you remember about that day all the way back in 59?
Yeah, that was my father's horse. I guess he named it after himself, Mr. Leatherberry. But, yeah, that was just some cheap horses he had that he knew that I was green and didn't know too much, but he entrusted me with them. Of course, they weren't. They were real cheap horses, which is the best way to learn. It's like driving a car. You know, you don't want to start out driving a Mercedes. You start out driving something that, if you mashed it up, it wouldn't cost that much.
Well said.
Well, you mentioned people were willing to help you along the way. Who are some of those trainers who took you in their way?
Basically, of course, trainers are everybody for themselves in this game. I remember, that's a funny little story I tell, but when one of the first outside owners I had a horse, had an entry in the race. It was my new owner and my father's horse. And we were sitting at that buoy, in the box, and the horses came down. They were head and head. They both hit the wire together, and we went down to the winner's circle, and I told him, I said, Dad, and I said, you know, I kind of hope the other horse beat you. He said, let me tell you something, son. In this game, it's everybody for themselves. So he ends up winning the photo. But I was kind of hoping to get my new owner to win, because I had my father as an owner. I didn't have to worry about him.
Well, Wayne Lucas says it's always good to be with the losing owner when that happens, because you can console him a little bit.
Right.
King, you mentioned Bowie, which is a name that many people, historians, certainly familiar with thoroughbred racing. Was that the first track that you started to go to the races and bet horses at?
Yes, it was close. And then we had a little half-mile track called Upper Marlboro, and we had like six or seven half-mile tracks in Maryland at the time. And Upper Marlboro was and Bowie was where I was raised, right within maybe 10 miles of those places. So that's the fond memories of Bowie, which was really a unique kind of track. We were the first track north of Florida to have winter racing, back when they started breaking into winter racing, and people would come down from New York. There was special trains coming from New York right into the back of the track. Back of the track had railroad tracks come right in it, and the trains would come right in there and empty. And another story was interesting. One of the trains wrecked on the way of about 2 miles from Bowie one time. And the fans literally got off of there and walked to the track, and some of them were bleeding, and they'd be standing in line buying their tickets with bloody shirts and torn jackets and everything from the wreck. But those are the kind of stories we got at Bowie.
These are hardened race fans for sure.
That's a great game. King, when you look back throughout your career, what are some of the memories that are going to stick out to you?
You know what? And people always ask me try to compare horses, and horses were different horses for different things. I mean, I had one horse, Fort Conway Lane, went 54 races, and he raced till he was 13 years old. And yet, then you have horses that were faster and better horses, but they didn't last as long. So it's the joy of winning, I think, is the main thing, whether it's a cheap race or a nice stake race. It's just something about winning. It's a thrill, and I still get that thrill after all this time.
Did you ever have a horse that you did like a lot of special work with that turned out pretty good that you're proud of? Not necessarily a famous horse or a fast horse, but some horse that was really kind of a difficulty as far as training was concerned or whatever, and you figured him out?
Well, yeah, it's just personal satisfaction you get out of that. And it's so many horses are a little bit different. A lot of them are you just do routine stuff. But some of them you have to dig down and try to find out what makes them tick. And so it's a personal satisfaction you get out of that.
King, you spent much of your career, the majority of it, as a claiming trainer in Maryland. I'm sure you've had opportunities or invitations in the past to maybe go to a larger circuit or train different types of horses. Talk about that decision to kind of remain with the claiming horses and remain in your home state of Maryland.
Well, that was one thing that I never was offered any. I had one guy offer me to stay. Well, he wanted me to give up all my other horses, which didn't make sense to do. But basically, I never got offered from any of the big-time trainers, I mean owners, rather. And that's because of the reputation of being a claiming trainer. And I've never had owners that really – I've had some wealthy owners, but none that would go down and buy the big yearlings, expensive yearlings or two-year-olds or anything. So basically, I've had to work with what I had. And the easiest horse to have is a claiming horse, and it's immediate action. You don't have to wait 2-3 years to get the horse there. So I was very successful at doing that, so I kept doing what I was good at, and never really had the trainers that would go to Kentucky and you know, buy the expensive yearlings.
You've been so successful with claiming horses, and I know, you know, you're winning at over 20% clip right now at the age of 80 years old, so I don't want you to give away any trade secrets or anything, but what's your philosophy when you claim one? Is there any particular types of horses that you look for?
Well, yes. I mean, I'm basically looking for an improving horse. And a lot of times the horses take a while coming to themselves. And if I can catch that, it's just almost like the stock market. You see something down that you think is going to go up in value, you grab it. But I'll look for horses that maybe should be running long, that the other trainer is sprinting, and horses that may be bred for the turf. I'm a firm believer of the breeding for turf ability. So if I see something bred for the turf, it's never been on the turf, I'll take a shot at it. And if it works, then I get an improved horse. If it doesn't, then I got what I got. So I just deal with percentages and logic, basically.
Maryland trainer King Leatherberry joining us on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. King, I mentioned that career began in 1959 with your first winner. Has the training game changed since the late 1950s?
Yes, it has, and people do things quite differently now than the old books. If you read some of those old books that was trained, you almost have to laugh at them. But things, of course, everything changes, and you have to kind of along change with it. I know the claiming game changed. When I first started claiming horses, people would get furious. And it's, I mean, really, man, fighting mad if you claim their horse. Nowadays, it's part of the business. They realize that, you know, that's the game, and and they accept it. And many of my friends I claim from, and they'll see me at the track, buy me a drink, really. But I'll still claim a horse from them because they realize that's how the game goes. So that changed a lot. Back, if you had a breeder back in the older days, they would get, you claim a horse from them, it was like declaring war.
Have you had to change your philosophy on training horses since you first started?
Well, yeah, the purses are better now, and that makes you claiming horses' philosophy better, easier rather, in that you can, you don't really have to get a horse that can win. Your purses are good enough. You know, your purses, if you can get a piece of it, second or third, you'll pay your bills, and that's all you want to do is nobody wants to lose money. And most owners are so used to not making money that that's no big deal with them. It's just that they don't, if you can pay their expenses going along, then they can have a hobby, and they can have a form of recreation and the fun of going to the races without costing them any money.
What do you think now about the situation where you can claim a horse and drop it and make money? Do you think that's good for the game?
Well, it works both ways. We had that in Maryland for a long time, and just recently the Racing Commission has changed it. Now we got to step up 25%. So basically it stimulates claiming, if you have the open claiming thing where you can run them anywhere, it makes you think twice about some of the horses that you claim if you've got to raise them up for 25% for 30 days. It makes you think twice there. And it's probably better for the game in that if you claim a sore horse and you have to step him up, it's probably better for the game in that it's better for the horse. Where a lot of people claim a bad horse, they'll run him right back next week on the drop, which is the worst thing you can do, is run a sore horse back quick. So from that standpoint, it's better to have the 25% raise.
King, that milestone win, number 6,000, came in 2003 when Cherokee Sunrise won at Timonium. Look back on that day and share your memories of that afternoon.
Well, that was a funny story, too, in that we expected to do it at Laurel. And we happened to hit a horrible slump. We just could not win. I mean, horses I'd send out there, they were even money. We'd get beat. And the cameraman followed me around for about 10 days at Laurel. And they're walking behind me every time I go to the paddock. They had signs made. They had all this stuff ready for the celebrate the 6,000 win. And I didn't do it. And we just went through the end of Laurel's meet. And here it was a big letdown for everybody. Then I go on over to Simonium, of course, I went over there. And they make a big deal out of it, but Laurel felt like they were hooked out of it, because Laurel's always been good to me, and they've promoted me, and they've done all kind of little deals and things for me, and so it was a shame that Laurel didn't get it. However, they did take advantage of it, because then when I got back to Laurel, they had some stuff for me, some gifts and a day where they celebrated my win. So it was a shame that Laurel didn't get it, but little old Timonium, which was appropriate because that's where I started out, around the Havers and the cheaper tracks. So that was an exciting day, but it was more of a relief to get it over with than anything.
You see that with a lot of sports figures too, like there are close to 2,000 hits or whatever, and they go into the worst slump. But do you think it was kind of the pressure you were feeling, or just one of those things?
I know. I met Joe DiMaggio one time at Laurel. He was up in the Sky Suite where I used to sit, and I met him, and they said, "What should we bet on?" I said, "Well, the trouble is, I'm in a terrible slump now." And he said, "I know what that is."
Yeah, it's amazing the way that pressure builds. And then we've heard so many trainers and jockeys, when they reach that milestone, they describe it as a relief, just like you did.
No, it's amazing how that happens. You're rolling along, clicking, clicking, then you get to one point, and then you just stall.
Yeah, Russell Bayes the other day, jocks were taking off and giving him their mounts so he could get to 12,000.
That's good.
Are you superstitious at all, King, with all the cameras around you and the signs and people having those made up ahead of time?
Yeah, that was pressure, but what could I do? I mean, I'm running horses just like I usually do, and they were getting beat. So that's something that you can, the bettors can use in their betting. I mean, when laws of averages get out of whack like that, and then you get a streak of wins, they come along the streak. That's one of my kind of the systems that I always use. If something doesn't happen for a long time that should happen, then when it does happen, it'll happen right along then for a while. So when somebody's in a slump, whether it's a rider or a trainer, and once he breaks that bad streak, then that's the time to jump on him.
King, I mentioned you were the nation's leading trainer in 1976 and 77. Looking back at your career, you've had so many high points. What points in your career, or maybe the point, would you consider to be the pinnacle of your entire career?
Well, that certainly was. But one of the strange things that happened, and it was a little bit sad because my father, who, of course, was a huge supporter of mine, and the year before I'm the leading trainer, during that year, he died. And so he never got to see me be leading trainer in the country. And the day that we buried him, it was absolutely amazing that I won 6 races that day. And I wasn't even at the track, of course, because I was at with my mother at the house after burying my dad. And I would call to see what my horses were doing. I'd call, it was at Laurel. I'd call, and they said, he won. I'd call back, he won. I called back, he won. It was 5 races I went at Laurel. And then I was running a horse, I think it was in Chicago. It was either Cleveland or Chicago. Forget now. And that darn thing won too. So it was almost like a something. I don't know what you'd call that, but to have 6 wins on the day I buried my dad was certainly something I'll never forget.
Yeah, very special. Maybe a little help from above. And when we look at the achievements and the honors that you've received, King, a Lifetime Achievement Award from the Maryland Athletic Hall of Fame in 2002, you were also enshrined in the Anne Arundel County Hall of Fame. And for all of your lofty numbers, just kind of curious, how on earth is King Leatherberry not in the Racing Hall of Fame? And does that bother you?
It doesn't bother me because it was explained to me, the head of the organization, the Hall of Fame people, his opinion is that you have to achieve that racing at the very top level. So that's his opinion, which I can understand that. It's 2 sides to that. So you know, you could take other thing in consideration that I have to deal with horses that I've had to have, not ones I want to have, but ones that came along. That's the other side of it, and so it's an argument on both sides. But I understand it. It doesn't bother me. God knows I've had enough awards for any person in a lifetime. It's just amazing. I've even had a thing down in Kentucky there that they gave me University of, what was it, Louisville?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I guess that guy at the Hall of Fame never saw Ben's cat running.
Yeah, well, Ken's cat, that probably would help me if I'd have nominated him to the Breeders' Cup, because I really think I could have could beat those horses. Some of the ones that's won it, I've beaten. So he's a remarkable horse, and but I just had never nominated him to the Breeders' Cup.
Well, I can imagine he must be among your favorites, isn't he?
Well, yeah, he has to be at this stage. I mean, he just keeps winning. He's a remarkable horse. It's just amazing. Every time he wins, we all say amazing.
Well, King, it's been an absolute pleasure to visit with you and hear your story tonight on Trainer Talk. And I know our listeners certainly enjoyed it. And we can't thank you enough for taking the time, and want to wish you all the best and continued success. And we're on the King Leatherberry for the Hall of Fame committee. So let's get that done.
Well, thank you very much. It's been my pleasure. And it's a lot of people that support me still to this day. People will tell me, and I had my people in the voting for me in the nominations. But like I say, I understand why I'm not, and it's okay. I've had my 15 minutes of fame about 1,000 times.
Well, King, like all of our guests who appear live on Trainer Talk, we receive gifts courtesy of EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So, King, we'll get those to you, and we appreciate you being with us tonight. Thank you so much.
Been my pleasure. Thank you.
Wow. That's all I can say. Amazing.
Amazing.
Yeah, just like Ben's cat.
Yeah.
Incredible. King Leatherberry, a legend. And great to finally have him on Trainer Talk. Bill Badgett Jr. coming up in the second half of the show. Can't wait to talk with him as well. So many great stories forthcoming from Bill on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Stay tuned.
Attention horsemen, are you getting the most out of your equine athlete? All natural EPO Equine could be the answer. EPO Equine is the most potent blood builder on the market. Top trainers like Scott Lake and Steve Margolis are reporting dramatic improvements in their horses. Easy to use and clinically tested, EPO Equine is the product your horses need for speed, strength, and stamina right out of the gate. Call 215-501-6880 or visit epoequine.com. Breathing easy is the key to equine performance and health. That's why horsemen around the world count on Flair nasal strips to protect the lungs of their equine athletes without drugs. Flair strips' gentle support of the nasal passages reduces the soft tissue collapse that occurs in all horses during intensive exercise. 7 clinical studies prove the benefits of Flair strips for reducing lung bleeding, reducing fatigue, and shortening recovery time. Reduce bleeding, recover faster, perform better. Prevent, protect, perform with Flair strips.
RacehorseReport.com.
What is it?
What is it?
What is it?
What is it, baby?
International racing, weekend stakes recaps, always free selections, great stories, workout information, racing news, handicapping tips, spot plays, and more.
It's as marvelous and as simple as that.
Join thousands of other thoroughbred racing fans by going to RacehorseReport.com. Make RacehorseReport.com your number one source for thoroughbred racing information.
That's great.
RacehorseReport.com.
This is Daily Racing Form's Dan Ullman with some big news about DRF bets. Thousands of players like you have already made the switch to DRF bets, and now there's an even bigger reason for you to join. Free DRF PPs. That's right, for the first time ever, get free Daily Racing Form PPs when you wager with DRF bets. These are the DRF past performances you know and love, and DRF bets is the only place you can get them free. So why wager anywhere else? With DRF bets, you'll get the best sign-up bonus in the business, free guides and analysis from DRF's top handicappers, breaking news, analysis, and wagering on the go with DRF and DRF Bets Mobile, one-click multi-ticket wagers with DRF Ticketmaker, and now free Daily Racing Form PPs. Only one place gives you the PPs you prefer when you wager, DRF Bets. Join today and wager with the most trusted name in racing. And if you sign up right now, you'll get a $125 cash bonus. Find out more at drf.com/bets. That's drf.com/bets.
The Haskell Invitational. Haskell
Invitational. And look at it, Lucky and Martin Garcia romping the Haskell. Coyle and Shackelford to the wire. Here's the finish. Coyle has won the Haskell. And Bob Baffert has won the Haskell again. Painter by four on the wire.
The Grade 1 Haskell Invitational, live from Monmouth Park, Saturday, July 28th, only on the Horse Racing Radio Network. It's Trainer Talk Wednesday on the Final Furlong on HRRN Live.
Mike Penna, Jude Feld, back with you on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Outstanding visit with King Leatherberry in the first half of the show, a true icon in our sport. And we now get to turn our attention to trainer Bill Badgett Jr., who himself has been entrenched in the history of this game. He's closing in on 600 career winners with more than $21 million in purse earnings. He trained the great Gopher Juan throughout her Hall of Fame career, and really looking forward to this visit here in the second half of the show. Bill, welcome to Trainer Talk. Bill, are you there?
Hello.
Do we have Bill? There's Bill.
There he is.
Bill,
oh, hey, guys. Sorry, I couldn't hear you there for a minute.
Oh, no problem. Welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Absolutely. And looking forward to this visit and looking forward to hearing your story. So why don't we start from the beginning, appropriately enough. And how did Bill Badgett Jr. get hooked on the sport of horse racing?
Well, believe it or not, my dad was a jockey in the 40s. He rode from like 1944 to 48, and before he started getting a little too big. And then he went to work for Woody Stevens, after he was done riding, and, he became an exercise boy. And then after that, he started going to, the Guggenheim estate and breaking Woody's yearlings, which that's when Woody had a private job for, Harry F. Guggenheim, Kane Hoy Stable. And, so I grew up in Port Washington on the Guggenheim estate when I was a little kid, and we used to go to Columbia, South Carolina every year, and where my dad would break the yearlings and then come back, and that's pretty much how I grew up.
Yeah, that's really rough. That's a tough way to get into the game.
Yeah, it was rough.
What do you remember about those? Obviously, you were just a little kid, but what do you remember about those early years and being around Woody and the stable?
It was really, well, unfortunately, I really didn't know what the heck was going on back then, but now that I can kind of reflect back on it, it was pretty amazing that, you know, just the old grooms they had in the barn and the horses and just the way things were run back then with the private jobs, it was pretty incredible.
Kane Hoy was one of the most prominent stables in the nation. And that had to be a thrill being around that type of horses.
Oh, yeah, it was pretty amazing. I used to, my dad used to go to Belmont on the weekends. So I used to ride out there with him and just kind of hang out at Belmont. It was really a pleasure just going out there and watching all the horses, One-Eyed King and Ack-Ack, and never been horses like that when you're growing up. Pretty impressive.
Yeah, talk about your dad just a little bit more, Billy, and look back on him and his career. And was he always encouraging about getting you into the game, or were there moments when he said, hey, you might not want to follow in my footsteps, kid?
Well, when I had approached him, I was offered a job by Peter Blum, and he said, nah, you really don't want to do that. I'd really rather you stay with me. And I said, well, you know, boss, I don't want to, you know, be here for the next 25 years and just, you know, walking around in your footsteps waiting for something to happen to you. I'd really like to go ahead and try it. So although he was a little bit disappointed, he said, you know, he sent me off with the best wishes. And, you know, so about 8 months later, Peter Blum fired me. reasons I don't know. So I was left with one horse. So Woody came over to the barn where I was. He said, how you doing? I said, oh, boss, you know, got one horse and hanging in there. So next thing I know, the next day I had six horses in the barn where he had told Mr. Belmont and Mrs. Moran and people that I kind of was associated in the barn with that I could use some help. So he really... It was amazing how much he helped me in going through a little bit of a hard time, but he was tremendous.
That's something that used to happen in the old days, not frequently, but a lot more frequently than it happens now. There's not a lot of trainers willing to give up horses and customers to somebody else.
No, that doesn't happen. But you know the amazing thing back in the days of, you know, Woody and those guys training, everybody had 36 horses. Everybody made a great living, and the guy used to say, you know, I have 36, but give so-and-so a horse, or give this guy a horse, or give that guy a horse. But yeah, those days are long gone. And that's, you know, the other impressive thing of Woody winning all those stakes and all those races, and certainly five Belmonts out of, you know, just 36 horses every year is pretty incredible.
It's a remarkable feat. And Bill, I asked King Leatherberry this question in the first half of the show. I'll ask you as well. How much has the game changed, and the training aspect of it? How much has that changed since when you first got into the game?
It's tremendously. I mean, growing up underneath those kind of horses, and certainly working for Woody for, you know, the 5 or 6 years I was there, you know, guys used to blow out horses on Thursday and run them on Saturday. I mean, those days are long gone. I don't, you know, everybody says they don't make horses like they used to, which is probably pretty true. But, I mean, you know, horses ran back a lot quicker than they used to. They were a lot sturdier. They held up to a lot more training. And, you know, if Woody was alive now and he couldn't blow out a horse on Thursday and run him back on Saturday, I don't know what he'd do. but yeah, you guys see it all the time. Horses don't run for 5 and 6 weeks. And then, you know, guys don't wait 5 weeks to run back in the Derby and skip this race and run back in 6 weeks. And I mean, if you look at last year's Preakness or this year's Preakness, how many horses even breezed from the Kentucky Derby into the Preakness? Maybe one.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's interesting that you bring that up, because you see the guys that did well, you know, Shug and Lucas win the first two legs with horses that had been racing very regularly, especially in today's day and age. And then Todd finally wins the Belmont because he finally got that horse raced into shape. But it's always kind of a puzzlement to me about, you know, this like two Derby preps and then nobody works anything farther than a half a mile. I just don't know how you get horses ready doing that.
Oh, I know. I don't know. I can't even remember when the last time people have worked a horse a mile or even 7/8, and that was an everyday occurrence in Woody's barn. Horses always breeze 3/4, 7/8, sometimes even a mile. I mean, it happened all the time. And, you know, I think, well, there's so much more racing now, and it's gotten so much more competitive, and there's so many places to run horses. And, you know, maybe in the past those guys didn't have the opportunities, whatever meet they went to. And then, you know, horses always got a break and either went to South Carolina and got turned out or, you know, wherever. But it's become so much more of a business now that it is a sport, that there's a lot more pressure on people too.
Bill Badgett Jr. joining us on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. This is the show the trainers listen to. And Bill, talk about your philosophy when it comes to training horses.
Well, you know, mine's changed quite a bit too, because, you know, I think, you know, good horses are probably a lot more sturdier than your everyday average claimant horse. So you have to just adjust with the individual. But so you just got to kind of change with the times, more or less. And, you know, the tracks are all different now with the sophistication of the, the back raking and the harrowing and the floating and the sealing and then, you know, poly tracks. And, you know, so everything's changed quite a bit as far as what you need to do on a daily basis with your horses.
Do you think a lot of trainers overtrain and underrun? I mean, it's so much easier to keep a horse on a schedule, running him every two and a half, 3 weeks, and then you don't have to do a lot with them in between time. But it seems like nowadays everybody's like, you know, training them, and then they run, you know, every 6 weeks. I don't quite get it.
Yeah, that's a great point. And you know, I don't know the answer to that either, but that's a great point. And, you know, I don't know if you just got to keep the horses. You know, I think it's, I'm like you, I think it's harder to keep them sounder, you know, more training. And I think, you know, if you did a little more running and less training, you'd probably keep them around a lot longer. But I guess it depends on the horse, too.
Now, Bill, you also spent some time working with Dominic Imperio and Joe Canty, if I'm not mistaken. Talk about those years and some of the things that you learned in working with those individuals.
Well, let's see, 1970, I just got out of high school and came to the track and just happened to walk into Dominic's Imperio barn and just asked for a hot walking job. So I started walking hots for him and just kind of moved my way up from a hot walker to a groom. And then a couple of, 2 or 3 years later, there was a couple of riders didn't show up. So he asked me if I knew how to ride. I said, yeah, I guess I could probably try. So I started galloping horses and doing everything else and then became assistant trainer for him. And then he kind of depleted on horses and then went to work for Joe Canty, which was at the time a tremendous opportunity. He was training for John Ed Anthony, Lob Lolly, and he had Temperate Silk, Cox's Ridge, and he had a lot of really, really good horses. So it was nice to be around those kind of horses. And Joe was a great trainer, too.
And then, of course, your first winner, you had the opportunity to win a race at Saratoga as your very first win. Not too shabby. A great way to kick off your career with S'mores in 1985. Look back on that day, and what do you remember about that afternoon?
Yeah, that was a lot of fun. And she was a very, very difficult filly to train. Funny story, we put her in ice boots for the first time, and about a week or so before the race, next thing I know, she's broke through the webbing and she's galloping around the backside of Saratoga with the ice boots on. And that was pretty funny. It took us quite a long time to catch her, but they were still on when we caught her, so I guess she got plenty of ice that day. But yeah, that was a lot of fun, and kind of something to kind of reflect on. But she was that was a nice day up there.
Where'd you watch the race?
Actually, I was kind of pretty nervous. I wasn't in the box there. I just watched it from the right by the finish line downstairs, just so I didn't have to be around a lot of people.
Is that still kind of your philosophy when you saddle these horses, or are you more comfortable now being up in the boxes and watching them live?
Yeah, I'm a lot more comfortable being up in the box. It's nice, especially like Saratoga and stuff. There's a lot of people up there, and you get to see everybody probably more in Saratoga than anywhere else, especially on our circuit, you know?
Yeah. Bill Badgett Jr. joining us on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bill, you had the privilege to be around the great Gopher Juan for her career. You trained her to that Hall of Fame accolade at the end of her career, and she was simply spectacular. Look back on the Gopher Juan years.
Yeah, that was very, very special. And Mrs. Lunger, Christiana Stable, she was an absolutely phenomenal owner. Just loved the sport. You know, I mean, you couldn't do anything wrong regardless of what happened. And then, you know, we were extremely blessed for that filly to come into the barn. Actually, Seth Hancock of Claiborne Farm recommended me for the job and got the interview and was able to get the job. And, you know, she actually had some pretty nice horses along with Gopher Juan. And so we took Gopher Juan to Saratoga of her two-year-old year. She had probably trained well enough to run up there, but I wanted to give her just a little more time. So, brought her back to Belmont where she broke her maiden, and it was kind of just history after that. But she was, you know, obviously a very, very special filly. And some of the races she lost was probably my fault. I probably should not have run her in the Kentucky Oaks. She didn't like the track when it was loose and cuppy, and the day she got beat, it just the tracks just happened to be like that. I believe Stella Madrid beat her at Beaumont. Track was very loose and cuppy that day, and she just didn't like it. But if it got muddy, it had some moisture in, you know, it tightened up. She just absolutely loved that.
Well, she won 10 of 13 lifetime starts, so she didn't lose very often. You didn't mess up very often, Bill. She was very impressive. You know, and the thing about this game, we talk about this a lot. We talk about it with several trainers on this show, is that you do experience, if you're in it long enough, you're going to get the highest highs. You're going to get the lowest lows. And Gopher Juan represented both of those for you, certainly. You're on top of the mountain in 1989 when she wins the Juvenile Fillies, and then the tragedy in 1990 in the Breeders' Cup Distaff. Just an amazing ride. How do you deal with those type of emotions?
Well, I mean, unfortunately, yeah, you always enjoy the highs, but, you know, in the back of your head, you can expect anything to happen in this business, you guys well know. And these horses, I mean, they're athletes. They're athletes. You've got to treat them like athletes, and they can go out there on any given day and get any kind of injury. And you kind of, although that was a blow you'd never expect, but it was very unfortunate. And you just got, you know, you're the captain of the ship. You just got to support everybody around you and keep everybody's spirits built up, and just just do the best you can. And the owners were extremely gracious, and it's still, at the end of the day, it's hard to take, but it's part of the game, unfortunately.
Does it make it difficult to show up at the barn the next morning after an incident like that?
Oh yeah, well, without a doubt. That's actually was the hardest day, even after all that. But like I said, you got to get in there and and just keep your barn pumped up and keep everybody's, you know, keep attention. You still got other horses to train, and just as hard as it is to put it behind you. And actually, I got a tremendous call from Mr. Whiteley, obviously, who had Ruffy, and then he said, listen, you know, you just got to hang in there, keep your head up, keep smiling, you know, keep doing what you do, and things will be okay. So that was a tremendous phone call.
Yeah, that had to help a lot. That's phenomenal. I'd never heard that story before.
And we had, you can't even imagine the people, the cards people sent, and letters and pictures and poems. And my God, it's just unbelievable. You could fill up a whole trunk with them. It was just, people were so nice.
Well, obviously, Gopher Juan represented a high point in your career on so many levels, but talk about some of the other horses that you've had the opportunity to be around, Bill, that maybe even some horses that people wouldn't recognize their names. They're not household names, but they really had an impact on you.
I had a little horse called Bevo. He was a Prospector's Gamble colt that I really liked. He belonged to a guy I trained for, actually, this Peter Calley, and I trained for the guy for 30 years and still have horses for him, which is, this day and age, hard to believe. But he was a pretty neat horse. He beat More Than Ready in the Futurity in a Grade One, and I think he might have won 5 out of 6 races. But he was a really neat horse, and had a horse called Timo. He won 3 or 4 or 5 stakes. I mean, I was so blessed to have tremendous, tremendous owners. I mean, Green Tree, Claiborne, Landon Knight, Short Leaf, Lob Lolly now. And so, you know, along with the names like that, you know, you're very, very lucky to once in a while just get some really, really nice horses.
Yeah, the name Lob Lolly is one that many people are going to recognize. They've been part of this game for so long and so much history there. Talk about that relationship with Lob Lolly.
That was really good. I mean, Mr. Anthony, I was lucky enough to be associated with when he was with Joe Canning. And he just happened to call me up one day and had a little mishap with Tom Bohan, and he said, you know, I need somebody to take care of these horses. So I kind of jumped in there and helped him out, and got a horse like Flitch and Clark Street and 4 or 5 really, really nice horses I was lucky enough to get from him. But he was kind of depleting a little bit out at the time, and then he wanted you know, as horse trainers to go to Arkansas, which that wasn't on our circuit at the time. So, but it was, you know, worked out great for 3, 4, 5 years. And he's a hell of an owner and a good guy and loves the game.
Bill Badgett Jr. joining us on Trainer Talk on the Horse Racing Radio Network. Bill, you had a point in your career not too long ago, 2004, when you actually announced your retirement from training. You spent a few years as a bloodstock agent and then decided to open your stable back up in May of 2007. Talk about that decision to retire and then and come out of retirement.
Well, I went through a divorce and just kind of needed to spend some time with my kids on a you know, as horse trainers, you don't get as much time as you'd like to being with your family and stuff. So I did that for a few years, and it actually worked out okay. And then I had an owner who had some horses with a couple other trainers. He said, listen, I'm going to get out of the game if you don't come back to training. So I said, well, you know, I'll take three or four, but I want to still do what I'm doing. And then one thing led to another, and here we are, we're back at it.
Yeah, back at it, and things going really well for Bill Badgett Jr. You're a New Yorker through and through. Born in New York, you reside in New York now. Did you ever consider leaving the Empire State, or was this something that you said, hey, I'm going to make my home here and my base, and we're going to do things in New York?
Well, yeah, pretty much. And I was actually, you know, when you're kind of starting out, you don't really know what's going to happen. You're maybe willing to maybe try other places and see if you can kind of make a try at it. But once I had my first child, now I have three, you kind of want to make yourself stay in one place if it's possible. And so we're lucky enough to have the horses that we had. We were able to stay in New York.
Well, when you have your first winter at Saratoga, it's kind of hard to go to Cahokia Downs.
Yeah, that was very lucky.
You mentioned your children, of course, your daughter Brooke and sons Brandon and Brian. Talk about the kids, and are they in the business, or have they expressed interest in it?
They love the business. I mean, they're Saratoga kids. You know, they like to hit the Saratoga the rest of the time they're in school. Brooke just graduated from Iona. Very proud of her for that. She's going to go to graduate school. Brandon's goes to the University of Albany. He'll be in his third year, and he's going to actually have a internship with NYRA this summer, working with PJ Campo. So he's looking forward to that. And my younger son, Brian, is thank God he's a lacrosse player. He got a scholarship to Boston University for lacrosse.
Oh, wow.
So that's very nice. And actually, he's going to work for NYRA this summer, too. So they love the horses. They love coming to the track and stuff. But I kind of – they see what, like, horse trainers go through every single day. And they said, you know, that hopefully one day they can have enough money to be horse owners and not horse trainers.
Would you encourage them to be a trainer if they came to you and said that they wanted to?
No, I would not. Yeah. I would let, you know, I'd love, you know, if they love the business that much, I'd love to see them in some aspect of the business. But, you know, horse training's gotten too difficult nowadays.
Now, I'm curious how you're going to make the move down to Boston to get in front of all those BU Terrier lacrosse games when you're training up in New York. How are you going to find time to
do
that?
I won't be having my New York Yankee hat on, I can tell you that.
Oh, you're a Yankee fan.
I love the Yankees.
Giants, Jets, either of
Giants
those two?
Giants and Yankees. The Jet guys are usually the Met fans, you know, so they kind of stay on the other side of the ocean.
You get a little rivalry with Rapoli up there, too?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely.
All right, Bill Badgett Jr., our special guest here on Trainer Talk. So, obviously, you're a baseball fan, and I know you're a lacrosse fan because of your son, but outside of those two sports, when you get an opportunity to get away, you're not at the racetrack, what other things does Bill Badgett Jr. like to do?
I used to play golf a little more often than I do now, and I think I might start trying to get back into it a little bit. But I do like to play golf.
Don't do it.
I know.
An evil game.
I've already been there.
I quit three times a year.
I know what you mean, believe me.
Well, hopefully we'll get a chance to catch up at Saratoga. Maybe we can get you out on the golf course. Ian Wilkes has already thrown down the gauntlet and told me that he wants a piece of me at Saratoga. So
okay.
Maybe there's lots of pieces of them to be had.
I'll caddy for you.
I should be caddy. Yeah. I shouldn't be playing. Trust me. Well, Bill, look, we really appreciate you being with us here on Trainer Talk. It's been great to hear your story. Of course, all of our guests who appear live on Trainer Talk will receive complimentary gifts from EPO Equine and Flair Equine Nasal Strips. So we'll make sure we pass those along to you. And really, really fun interview. Thanks so much for being here with us
hey,
tonight.
Guys, I really appreciate you having me. Thanks again.
All right. Good luck this year.
All right. Thank you.
All right, Bill Badgett Jr. Here on Trainer Talk. And What an addition to Trainer Talk tonight, really. We start things off with the legend King Leatherberry in the first half of the show. Now Bill Badgett. If you missed any portion of the show, you can go back to our website. A podcast will be available for you shortly. You can listen at horseracingradio.net and on iTunes as well. Just search Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes to hear those interviews and their stories, and so many great stories over the course of the last hour.
Yeah, I know. It's been a fantastic show, and it's... a lot of people have come up to me recently and said how much they like having them on iTunes because they listen to them when they go running and stuff.
Yeah. It's yeah. Cool. And now, of course, all of our weekday shows are going to be streamed live on our website, horseracingradio.net. So you can go there and you can click and you can listen. You can also listen on your iPhone or your iPad. It is now capable of doing that. So take us with you wherever you go. And certainly the iTunes thing, another option.
The little... click on listen live button on our website. Fantastic.
Yeah.
I use that all the time.
We did that in Florida last weekend. We were down there for the Summit of Speed.
That's right. I listened to the boys' call-in show. I actually called in.
I heard that.
I told them. First time caller, long time listener.
You should be. we should do a Trainer Talk with JT.
I'd be up for it. Any day you want to do it, you let me know.
I'm going to hit you up with the hard questions, though, man. No softballs for you.
It's okay. I can answer them all. I got a million stories.
That would be maybe on a slow day when nobody else wants to come out. We'll have Jude.
Yeah, that's best. I'm best on a slow day. My horses were best on slow days. Thursdays, I told you that was my day. Went all my big races on Thursdays.
Well, speaking of Thursdays, we are back tomorrow with our HRN live coverage from 3 to 6 Eastern time. And that coverage encompassing racing from Belmont Park. And then we're going to have our Bristnet.com call-in show tomorrow night from 6 to 7. That is every Thursday night. It's your opportunity to call in and talk racing with Chad Summers and with the Uber capper Ellis Starr and Ed DeRosa from Briss. A lot of people love to call up and ask him questions about the Briss products or Twin Spires or whatever it might be, and even just call on his knowledge of racing. You can do that by calling the BrissNet.com call-in show tomorrow night. On Friday, our HRN live coverage from 3 to 6, and then the Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview from 6 to 7. And if you're looking for winners over the weekend, you probably want to make sure you're tuning in to the Express Bet Weekend Stakes Preview, because JT, you and the Uber capper last week were absolutely en fuego.
Yeah, we had a pretty good week. I think, I was smiling most of the day at Calder, and I don't know what the Uber was doing. I saw a couple tweets. He was self-promoting there about his top selections, but it was a good
Shocker.
Show. We had some nice races to work with. I mean, sometimes there's not a lot to work with, but we had some good betting races, and that always helps.
And we do want to tell you that starting next Wednesday evening, this Trainer Talk show will have a brand new title sponsor. You remember throughout the breeding season, it was Bullet Train, Frankel's three-quarter brother, who was the title sponsor of Trainer Talk. Well, next Wednesday night, we're going to welcome in the folks at Fasig Tipton. And this show, Trainer Talk, will be presented by Fasig Tipton starting next Wednesday evening. So we want to thank them for all their support. And you'll be hearing a lot more about Fasig Tipton over the coming months. And, of course, throughout all of their major sales. Pretty cool sale coming up at Fasig next week as well.
Yeah, the Horses of Racing Age sale. And I was looking at that catalog this morning. pretty impressive bunch of horses.
Yeah, salty group. And they just got Starship Truffles for that catalog.
Yeah, who we just saw win.
Yeah.
I was thinking maybe I should call somebody and see if they want to buy her.
Maybe so.
Then I could be on Trainer Talk.
All right, well, a fun visit. Again, King Leatherberry, Bill Badger Jr., we thank them for coming on the show tonight. Check out a podcast on our website and Horse Racing Radio Network on iTunes. For our producer, Lee Delapina, Jude Feld, I'm Mike Penna. We'll talk to you next time on HRN.
Good night, Barbados.